And so we decided to resume the journey at that point, but we still kept the same goal. So we lost about 3.5-4 months, but then kept the same goal of 100. So it ended up being a little bit harder the second year as far as the pace once we got back on course. And then towards the end of that year, by fall of that year, I was just doing the calculations, and I realized that if I did 105 Ironmans, I would beat the current, even though I wouldn't technically have the world record, I could beat the current world record 2 years in a row. So that's what I ended up doing.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. This week, I'm chatting with Will Turner. Will is a peak performance coach, working with businesses, coaching sales teams, mostly dealing with mindset and peak performance. He puts that into practice in his own life because Will is an Ironman triathlete. He was looking for a big goal to celebrate the year that he turned 60, so he decided that he would go out and complete 60 Ironman triathlons in the year of his 60th birthday. He completed the goal, then he kept on going. He went the following year, and he continued running, ran a total of 105 Ironmans in a two-year period, which beat the world record. Hope you enjoy listening to my conversation with Will Turner. One of the reasons I found out about you from a mutual acquaintance told me about your exploits doing 60 triathlons when you turned 60. But usually, you know, that wasn't the first thing that you did. You started earlier than that. When did you get your start, like doing, you know, running and triathlons and endurance stuff?
I did my first triathlon in my back in like 1993, 1994. Mm-hmm. And then by the early 2000s, I was doing marathons. And then 2009, I was turning 50 and I decided I wanted to do my first Ironman triathlon. So did that, then moved into some ultra endurance triathlons.
So what is an ultra endurance triathlon? I mean, I know the Ironman is the one that I'm familiar with. What
right.
is
so ultra is anything above that Ironman distance. So there are actually double, triple, quintuple Ironmans, even up to deca and double decas. So yeah, it's a very small cult world. Yeah. So it's multiples of a regular Ironman.
Okay. Yeah, and there's a lot of, you know, in the ultra marathon community, there's, you know, the official is anything longer than a marathon, right, is the official designation. So if you run 27 miles, you've officially run an ultra, but usually they start at 50K.
Right. So with the ultra triathlons, it's just, it becomes multiples of an Ironman.
So okay. So you don't have like, 1.5 Ironman.
Right. You got to bounce up.
So how do they do that? I would imagine each distance then is double, like the swim is double, you wouldn't go through the whole thing twice.
Right. Well, actually there's for a double distance, it's actually double the distance. So it's a 4.8 mile swim. It's a 224 mile bike, and that's a 52.4 mile run. But when you get into the triples and the quintuples, into the decas, the even longer than the doubles, then they often have a format where you can do all of the distances continuous like that, all the swim, all the bike, and all the run. And they also have a one a day version. So you literally are just doing an Ironman every day for whatever multiple you're doing.
Okay. Okay.
Depends on the race itself, but
yeah. So how big is that community? I mean, that seems like, I mean, people talk about ultra marathon runners being kind of nuts, but
yeah, I saw something recently. There are probably about 300 people that are actively doing something throughout the year or over a year or two period. So the community is a little bigger than that, but it's a relatively small community. In fact, a lot of the people that do it are not U.S. based. That we a lot of European athletes. It's bigger over there than it is over here. People in Mexico, people in Asia. So it definitely pulls from a lot of different areas, but Europe is probably the biggest area.
Now that would be the strategy. I'm trying to think. DECA would be five.
Ten. Yeah.
What kind of time limit do they have on those? I mean,
it's for the DECA. I forget because I haven't done a DECA, but it's over probably about a 14-15 day period.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Okay. So it'd be more like the Ironman's version of the Tour de France. I would imagine. Yeah.
So I've gone up to the Quint, which is the five times, and that's a 5.5 day event, basically.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. So you did was that what were you doing the Quint before you decided to do your 60 at 60?
I did it a couple of years before that, as a little bit of a test run, just to push myself and see, even though they're different types of events, just to really push myself and see what I was capable of and what I wasn't capable of. And
so I take it you managed to finish that.
So this race was a 12-mile swim, a 560-mile bike, and a 131-mile run.
Okay.
And I ran out of time 7 miles short on the run.
Wow.
So I completed the swim, completed the bike, and I was 7 miles short of finishing. So it was a pretty humbling experience, but also in retrospect, a really good one, just because it helped me go to greater lengths to figure out what I need to do differently moving forward and how I could, improve my chance. I basically got to the point where my back was so knotted up that I was kind of limping along like Quasimodo towards the end of my run portion, and just, was going not very fast and ran out of time before it was all over.
Well, and that's a common thing that happens to ultra runners as well. I mean, there are a lot of times that you'll see ultra runners will have, their backs, they just can't support the motion. And so they kind of end up leaning to one side.
Definitely.
Yeah. So you have always kind of been an endurance, that's kind of always been your thing. What's the thing that kind of motivated you?
I think the reason I've stayed in the endurance sports world for, the last couple decades, is just to me, it always pushes yourself. I call it, whenever you're training or whether you're racing and you get to that place where you just want to quit and stop and walk or do whatever. I call that place the sweet spot. And there's nothing sweet in that moment.
Yeah.
But when you do push through and you get to the other side and you finish, it's like drinking a golden elixir. It's you just are filled with confidence and just the realization that you can do so much more than you thought you could. And I always find that in the longer distance events, that I'm going to find those places where I get in that sweet spot where I've got to push myself. I've got to decide. I've got to be mentally tough enough to kind of grind through and use whatever grit I've got to push to the other side. And it's me coming back.
So does that, and I'm assuming that doesn't happen the same place. You can't really predict where that's going to happen.
Not at all. Every day is a little different. Every course is a little different and conditions are different. You quite never know what's going to happen exactly. But in the, so when I was getting ready to turn 60, I decided to do 60 Ironmans a year. I turned 60 years old. And I was talking about it to a friend one day, and I would post update race reports and that sort of thing. And somebody said, it seems like every race you've got some obstacle to overcome. And it's like, yeah, pretty much I do. You just never know what, whether the condition, whether it's the terrain, whether it's the elevation, what's going to hit you. but something usually is there waiting for you. You just have to be ready for it when it comes.
Yeah. And so I would imagine I've never done an Ironman. I've just swimming is not one of my things. And so yeah. I was like, stay out of the water. Right. I mean, I can swim, but I don't swim well enough to go that kind of distance.
Right.
Although a friend of mine told me that Chattanooga yes. Ironman, he says, if you jump in the river, all you got to do is stay afloat.
I was training a woman for her first Ironman who was not a particularly strong swimmer. She was a really strong runner. And she picked Chattanooga because it's a great course for people who are not strong swimmers.
Yeah. Yeah. But I kind of imagine that you would be able to get through that fairly without getting into those kind of places where you call the sweet spot.
Running, I mean, swimming is pretty, it's the shortest part of any triathlon.
Yeah. And so, it's at the beginning.
So you're fresh. And so it's not bad. It's not till you get into the bike and the run that you usually hit more of the obstacles along the way.
Yeah. Yeah. And cycling has its own. And if I remember it right, in cycling on an Ironman, you are on your own. You're not, you can't like pull in behind somebody and have them break the wind for you.
That's right. Kind of frowned on. Crafting is not legal. So you're definitely on your own. In fact, you can get penalized and or DQ'd for drafting off somebody.
Okay. Okay. So yeah, you're really there. And so yeah, you would find those places, I would imagine, on the hills and some of the, you could have wind conditions that would be against
wind
you.
And heat and, just tough elevation climbing and that sort of thing can make it a lot harder.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you have to get off and run a marathon. And I'm still thinking, still going back to the ultra, because I didn't realize they had the ultra Ironmans. And I'm still thinking of that as like, doing all of that, 500 and some miles, and then running a over 100 miles after that. That's a that's a lot.
It is a lot.
It is a lot. Well, I mean that there are ultra marathons now that are 200 to 350 mile races and multi-day stage races. In the deserts. I mean, there are a lot of, the ultra marathon type equivalents of having to do those kinds of.
Absolutely. Kinds of things. And there's a bit of a crossover between those two communities, between the ultra tri community and the ultra running community.
Yeah.
A bunch of my friends who do the ultra tri stuff will also do some of the ultra running events as well.
Yeah.
So same mindset.
Yeah.
Similar. Crazy.
the running, I know cycling is usually on the road. Triathlons or Ironmans are usually on the road as well.
Most of them. There are some that have some trails as part of the course. I'm training right now for a double it's an Anvil race, but it's a double Ironman distance, and it's in Oregon in June. But a big part of the run loop is on trails.
Oh wow! Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah. So that would add a different hold, another different dimension. So.
Yeah. Exactly.
So you had a pretty good amount of endurance before you set your 60 at 60.
I didn't. I was in that world, but it definitely was a big jump for me. In fact, So when I did my first Ironman, I was turning 50 and wanted a big, hairy, audacious goal, a BHAG to kind of go after. And a couple of years before I was turning 60, I thought, well, when I get 60, I want to do something big, just like I did when I was turning 50, since it's one of those milestone birthdays. And I had originally thought I would do 6 Ironmans the year I turned 60, and I thought that would be huge. And I was out at a local triathlon race cheering on some of the athletes that I was coaching. And I ran into a friend of mine, and she asked me if I had any big races coming up. And literally like the week or two before, I had made the decision that I wanted to do 6 Ironmans a year. I turned 60 in a couple of years. And so she was the very first person I shared it with. And I said, well, I'm thinking about doing 6 Ironmans a year. I turned 60. And very matter-of-factly, she goes, oh, like Som, who was a local triathlete who had turned 60 a couple years before, who had done six Ironmans. And so here's this thing that I thought was a big, hairy, audacious goal. I mentioned it to the first person, and they tell me about another local athlete that done the exact same thing. And so I went back to the drawing board and said, well, that doesn't sound like it's so big, hairy, and audacious if somebody else has done it. And I don't know if you've heard of like the 10X factor, the 10X goals, where you take a goal and you multiply it by 10.
Yes.
Well, after a lot of mental gymnastics to wrap my head around it, I decided that I'd go from 6 to 60 Ironmans in a year. And so I multiplied the original goal by 10. And then I found out in the process that the Guinness World Record for most Ironmans in a year was 44. So I was like, ooh, this is, you know, so it definitely took a lot of getting my head around it. And also at that point, I had about 2 years to do the prep work,
okay,
mentally and physically, to see if it was possible. So,
what was your training like in those two years? So,
2 years before, three years before I'd done the quintuple.
Okay.
And then the next year, I decided that I was going to do. I was doing a virtual DECA pursuit that an endurance friend of mine in Texas was running, and basically you'd go out and do your own. You could do actual races, but you go out on your own and do your own versions of a Ironman distance race and record it and all that sort of stuff. And the goal was to do 10 during the course of the year, which for most athletes would be a whole, you know, a lot, right?
Right.
So I decided to do that a couple times throughout the year. So I ended up doing 20 some Ironmans as preparation, just to see how my body would hold up, to see you know, test recovery and what I needed to do to feel better and perform better and those sorts of things. So it was a lot of just going out there and grinding it out on my own. And seeing how I responded and making little tweaks and adjustments along the way. And also just building the confidence. Okay. I'm pretty durable. I'm doing this. I'm not getting myself injured, because that's probably the biggest, you know, fear is, you know, if I start this and I get injured somewhere along the line, that could be the end of it right there. So just making sure you're training smart and you're being smart and you're, doing everything you can to stay healthy.
Yeah. And so you were doing these Ironman distances kind of on your own, just out.
Yep. I just wake up, you know, I just plan it, you know, into my schedule, maybe on a weekend or wherever. And I just would go out and do it. It's called On Your Own, OYO. And I just would go out and, you know, map out a course and go out and do it and, you know, see how it was.
Yeah. So, you said you did mental preparation as well. What was your mental training like? Did you have a strategy for it?
I love the mental side of things. So I'm always testing, you know, what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, I think, you know, the biggest part is the belief part, right? Of realizing that, you know, you can do it and having that belief that you do. So part of the training of doing the 20 some, you know, a couple of years before was, you know, to build that belief system in myself, you know, that this is possible, that I can hold up and I can do it without harming myself and that sort of thing. And just, you know, also in all sorts of different types of conditions. So, you know, really getting used to doing it and at elevation or doing it in really hot weather or cold weather and those sorts of things, so that you can build up just the mental resiliency and the grit to know that you've been there, done that. You know, when I was doing the 60 at 60, I had faced pretty much almost every kind of situation in training or other races by the time I got there. So, you know, when your leg is cramping up in the middle of a lake or you're dehydrated on the run, or, you know, you have coping mechanisms. So what do I do now? I've been here before. I know what to do. And so really tapping into that prior experience and knowing in those moments that, okay, I go into problem solving mode now. What do I need to do to fix this? What do I need to mitigate the potential damage here? instead of, you know, getting that place and freaking out like, oh my God, you know. And a big part of it too is just, I think, the self-talk, particularly in those moments when it gets tough, you know, you can let the negative frame kind of run its path and kind of derail you, or you can really kind of take control of your thoughts and let it lead you in a direction of moving forward versus kind of crumbling in the crisis.
Mm-hmm. So do you have a plan going in for your self-talk?
In the sense that for a particular race, I might have a mantra that I would use for a race, or I would have certain affirmations that I may pull out. I have quotes that I usually pull on, and also just, if I had certain people or that were supporting me that I, you know, could use them as part of my positive talk as well. And just that gratitude piece of having that support system.
Yeah. So you had people who were kind of helping you. I'd imagine you couldn't really do these all by yourself.
Right. I had, if I wasn't doing an official race, if I was doing it on your own, there aren't actually 60 Ironmans in the world in a year. Mm-hmm. So a lot of them had to be on my own. And I had a support person, I called my Uber Sherpa, who was out there most of the time. And other times I had other people, but basically I had my Uber Sherpa that was out there just to make sure that I was, you know, alive and well and would move the vehicle if needed with, you know, what I needed with hydration or you know, food, nutrition, that sort of thing, because I'd often have a cooler full of stuff that needed to be accessible when I needed it. That sort of thing.
and you did your 60 in a year, right?
I did. Yeah.
And if I remember reading, the Guinness Book of World Records had some requirements that were kind of tough.
Yeah. The biggest one the only one that really kind of threw me off, which I don't have the official Guinness record, was that you needed two independent witnesses. And independent witnesses meant that it could not be somebody that you knew, couldn't be a friend or a relative. And so even though I recorded everything, my Uber Sherpa was not an independent witness by the Guinness standards. So I couldn't meet that requirement. It meant that I basically would have to hire two strangers that would follow me around for the year and, you know, make sure that I completed it.
And I kind of think, how would you even put that in a job description? And who? And how would you pay them? Am I going to? Yeah, I could see that. And you don't get any monetary reward for holding the world record. So
it was costly enough just to do them without having to pay other people to help me do them.
I had a guest on she's working on the most ultra marathons run in a year.
Oh, wow.
And so she was able to be, you know, she was able to find official ultra marathons and enter them. But she had to take pictures with people, prove that she was there.
Right.
You know, get her, you know, the race director had to sign off on, you know, yes, she actually ran this. I didn't see her publish it. I interviewed her in the middle of it. I know she's still running ultras, so yeah. I think she just kind of enjoys it. So she keeps going.
Yeah.
Here's a message you need to know. It's not too late. A lot of people get to age 40 or 50 years old. They look at life and think, I'm running out of time. You know those plans and dreams you had of doing something epic, doing something big, doing something significant? Travel the world, start your business, write your novel, make your documentary, become an Iron Man. All of those dreams sometimes seem to be fading into the mist as you get older. But here's the thing, it's not your age that holds you back. It's called limiting belief. And all of this, every one of us have limiting beliefs. And a huge majority of people are very happy and content to live all their lives inside the boundaries of these limiting beliefs.
But if you're listening to this show, I'm going to guess that you're not like the majority of people out there. I would think that you want to have more from life than just being average. So if you do find yourself held back by limiting beliefs, if you find yourself saying, you know, I know what I should be doing, but I just can't seem to make myself do it, I can help. Go to the ultramindsetpodcast.run, schedule a free 25-minute mindset reset with me. I'll help you get started on getting you on your way to overcoming your biggest obstacle that's holding you back. That is ultramindsetpodcast.run. If you're on a computer, it will be off to the right. If you're on a phone, scroll clear to the bottom. Find a calendar there. You can get on my schedule for a free 25-minute mindset reset. It is not too late. But you kept going, I think, if I remember.
I did. I ended up doing 105 in 2 years. So my Uber Sherpa, Chris, at the end of the year, he said, Will, I don't think we're done yet. And I'm like, yeah, we are done. We did it.
Well, he wasn't the one, you know, swimming and running and biking.
Exactly. But, you know, one of the things, I didn't want to just be out there running and swimming and biking just for myself. I mean, although I did want that challenge for myself, I started something I called Live Your Bold, which was a way for me to give back during my journey. And I did a lot of speaking to kids at schools and put together resources for people that wanted to push through their limiting beliefs and kind of, you know, break through their status quo and those sorts of things. And so I was using my platform to kind of spread the word and speak to kids and that sort of thing. And we were also doing a lot of pretty amazing races in a lot of national parks, which was pretty awesome, you know, just to be in such beautiful places and be able to, you know, do these races. And so I told Chris when he said that we needed to keep going, I said, well, yeah. I said, I'm not going to just do it to do it. I think we've accomplished what we wanted to accomplish. But I said, if we could, his point was we were starting to build a platform, particularly with the kids, that, you know, maybe now that we had a platform, we could reach out to more people. I said, well, if we could reach more people, if we could bring more awareness to the national parks, because at that time, the Trump administration was cutting funding to the national parks and that sort of thing. And so, I thought if we can do that and make that part of the journey, then, you know, he twisted my arm and I said, okay, let's go to 100. Let's continue with the 60 and go to 100. And I thought, you know, this is going to be a lot easier because doing 40 in a year versus 60, you know, obviously.
Yeah, but what's another 40 more, right?
So we kind of took a little break at, you know, finished at the end of 2018, took a break the beginning of January, was back on the road in February, and Chris ended up getting a diagnosis of cancer.
Oh, wow.
And so we ended up putting everything on pause. Obviously, his health was much more important than me to continuing out there just, you know, doing Ironmans. And so he ended up having kidney cancer, you know, between the diagnosis and all the tests and the surgery and recovering, it was about 4 months from mid-February till the end of May.
Okay.
And at the end of May, he was ready to go back out there and kind of resume life as he knew it beforehand. And he said that he wanted more than ever to go back out there with me. And so we decided to resume the journey at that point, but we still kept the same goal. So we lost about 3.5-4 months, but then kept the same goal of 100. So it ended up being a little bit harder the second year as far as the pace once we got back on course. And then towards the end of that year, by fall of that year, I was just doing the calculations and I realized that if I did 105 Ironmans, I would beat the current, even though I wouldn't technically have the world record, I could beat the current world record 2 years in a row. 65 and the next. So that's what I ended up doing.
That's because I kind of wondered. I knew you'd done 105, and I thought, oh, well, I wonder where did the five come from?
But it's, yeah, at first I thought, well, you know, maybe I should just average doing one a week, you know, over 2 years, and that would have gotten me to 104, you know, 50 weeks in a year times two. And I thought, oh, well, that's a good, you know, bumping it up from the 100. And then I thought, well, if I do one more, that breaks the world record, even though I don't have it. It's just kind of like a, hey. So I went ahead and just added another one up just for the fun of it.
So I'm taking guessing that the current world record holder did find some couple of strangers to follow them around. Or
I think feasibly do that is, well, you can do as many races as you can that are official races, but again, you're going to fall really short. I've seen people, I think the way it was done, and I couldn't find verification of this, is that you have to do it on, like, stay still on the same course and do the same thing every day and have somebody come out to do that. What I was doing is I was traveling all over the U.S. and Canada doing races all over the place. Mm-hmm. But if you had a home court, so to speak, where you could bring somebody in and they were just there every day,
right,
in place, then I think that's probably how it was done.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Well, and I can understand the appeal of traveling. I mean, you got to go. I mean,
oh, just so many amazing places. I mean, Big Sur, Death Valley, Yosemite, the Tetons, Glacier National Park, bunch of places, Crested Butte in Colorado, Boulder. You know, most of mine were out west. Again, my Uber Sherpa Chris is actually a photographer. And he said one of his conditions for helping me through all this was he wanted to go to these epic places and take photographs. And he's also a pretty hardcore mountain cyclist. And so he wanted to be at these places too for his own, you know, personal enjoyment when I wasn't out there suffering. And so he ended up taking the most amazing pictures. And throughout the journey, every time I'd post a race report, people would be like, they were more interested in the pictures than they were what I did pretty soon. You know, because the pictures were so amazing. And so we ended up getting so many people say, oh, you got to put together a coffee table book, this, you know. And so lo and behold, we ended up doing that just because we weren't planning on doing it, but people just wanted it because the photographs were so amazing. And they were particularly amazing just because of the locations that we had. Yeah. So it was definitely great to be able to travel to some of the most beautiful places in the world. I mean, when we started that second year, when we got through the cancer scare, you know, Chris is like, we've got to go bigger and bolder than we did last year. And like, what are we going to do? And he's like, we need to go to Denali in Alaska. Uh-huh. Which is the highest peak in the, you know, in North America.
Right.
And so we ended up going to drive. I have a little teardrop camper I got driving around to all these places. And I did a couple races in Canada, one near Whistler, and then drove 3,000 miles from Whistler all through, you know, British Columbia and the Yukon and Canada and across Alaska. It was like 3,000 miles just to get from the lower part of Canada to where we were going in Alaska to get an Ironman down there. And then we came back through the Canadian Rockies and did, you know, some near Banff and Jasper, which are, you know, some of the most beautiful scenery in the world. So pretty great.
Wow. That is quite a trip.
Yeah. I literally put on, I figured it out at one point that first year we were averaging about 1300 miles a week, plus doing all the races and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, you have to learn to recover and adjust on the fly, but you're putting a lot of mileage on the car in the process.
Well, and you had to do more than one a week.
Basically averaging one about every 6 days.
Okay.
But it varied a lot because I was still doing some work virtually. I was working virtually and locations varied a lot. So, and we were working around official races. And so sometimes I might do one and then 3 days later, do another one. Some days it might be 8 or 9 days later, but had to average one every 6 days.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you did some official races.
I did 12 or 13 official races throughout the 2 years.
Yeah. So you kind of, this kind of led into you working to inspire others, with your, Live Your Bold. So is that something that you've kind of continued? Is that an organization you're still?
I still, do a lot of speaking. Obviously it changed a lot with the pandemic, and everything going virtually. I really enjoyed getting out there and just sharing my story and how it can relate to other people. And so that's been a big part of it too.
Have you found, what kind of response have you found with people? I mean, especially because I know a lot of runners, especially, and people who are in their 40s who kind of look at 60 years old and think, you know, I'm going to be over. I won't be able to do anything by the time I'm that old. Yeah. And I think I thought that when I was when I was younger as well.
Yeah. I've always been really inspired when I see athletes that are older than I am out there doing it. Cause it gives me that confidence and belief that, okay, if somebody else is doing it at that age, then, you know, that means it can be done. And that means that if I play my cards right, I can be one of those people as well.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when one of my very first triathlons, it was a shorter distance triathlon, and I was there for the award ceremony. And there was a guy that was from my gym who had won like the 55-year-old category. And I was at the time in my 30s. And I thought, you know, when I'm in my 50s, I want to still be doing this. I want, you know, just having that as a role model. And you see some amazing people in their 60s and their 70s and 80s and even higher that are out there doing some pretty amazing things in the ultra endurance world, whether mm-hmm. it's running or triathlon. And so I'm inspired by that. And if I can inspire somebody else along the way, then that's wonderful.
Yeah. And I've seen that too. I've seen the people who are in their 80s and are still out there and, yeah. you know, plugging away. And I am going to be that, I'm going to be that person.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing that I found is it's the consistency and just the being smart as we get older, just to make sure that we're doing things well so that we can avoid injuries. You know, knock on wood, I've learned the hard way many years ago with injuries, and I'm very much what I consider a Zen runner or a Zen athlete. And what I mean by that is just being very mindful of myself and my body. And if I have anything that is not feeling quite right, I pay attention to it. I don't, you know, there was a time when I would just kind of muscle through it and like, I can do this. And then, you know, you end up injuring yourself or something like that. And I've learned the hard way that when your body is not right, it tells you often many times before it gets really bad.
Uh-huh.
You know, we think that we're so tough that we want to kind of grit through it. And that's not always the best thing. And so if I can pay attention and be mindful of what my body needs and what I need to do with it and how hard to push it or not push it at any given time, then I can keep it healthy for the long term.
Do you find that that allows you to work through some things that maybe would have injured you in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I ended up training for a marathon this is early 2000s. And I was also doing triathlons at that time, shorter distance triathlons. And I ended up having a partial tear in my patella tendon. And I didn't know what it was. I just knew that my knee hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And but I soon discovered that my knee didn't hurt more when I ran or biked. It still hurt, but it didn't hurt more. And so I also knew that if I went to my doctor, that my doctor would say, you know, we'll stop training for the marathon. You need to, you know, get this taken care of. And I was being very stubborn and I thought, well, I'll just go to the doctor after the marathon. You know? So I knew I wasn't going to PR in the marathon. So I, I, I wore a tutu, a pink tutu, and I put on a shirt. I said, something to the effect of, I shouldn't really run. I've got a bum knee, but the marathon is just too fun, or something like that. Ended up doing the marathon, ended up going to the doctor afterwards, ended up probably taking about a year and a half to go through all different types of things before I actually had some surgery to repair it and getting back to the place I was prior to the injury. Mm-hmm. And that was just me being young and foolish and thinking I could just, avoid the pain or ignore the pain. And I don't do that anymore. I'm older and wiser because of it. So is
it difficult to kind of know where's the line when you're in there, in that?
Yeah, I apparently it is for some people, because I've gone to some people and they're like, I don't know what you're doing, because I'm always crossing the line. I'm getting injured all the time. I haven't been injured in years and years. I mean, like over a decade. So I think I'm pretty good at recognizing the line. I will play on the side of being cautious more often than not. And cautious in an early stage of feeling something that's not quite right is, pulling back a little bit, maybe getting a massage, looking at, skipping a couple runs or whatever it might be, so that you're not out. I'd rather skip one or two runs here or there and listen to my body than, get to a point where I'm out for 3 or 4 months or something like that. So I think, there's a different, to me, the difference is there's a point where you're just pushing it and it's hard because you're giving it all you've got and, kind of going to the mat with it. And then there's hard where you physically are feeling, a pain in a muscle or some part of your body that shouldn't be there. So it's more the exhaustion versus the more acute pain, type thing. And so I just pay attention to that and adjust myself accordingly.
And the exhaustion is kind of what you mentioned earlier is your sweet spot. That's the place where you're kind of bringing your self-talk to bear and say, convincing yourself this is something to push through.
Exactly.
And the pain. So yeah, that's a good skill to be able to have, and that's a great track record.
So. Yeah. And I think you just get better at it if you're more present and mindful with yourself. When you get that little niggle in your knee or your IT band or something like that, you just don't go, oh well, I hope it goes away. But really, just kind of pay attention to it.
So yeah, did you have, you said about every 6 days, what was your recovery strategy like? What was the thing? How did you take care of yourself in between those events?
The first thing is, to me, the magic thing is getting recovery, hydration, nutrition in you immediately after the race. So having a regimen to make sure that happens. And then beyond that, it was some light stretching and active recovery. So maybe walking or light exercise, not necessarily running, biking or swimming, but just walking or hiking and being active and that sort of thing. So just making sure that my body was moving, and that I was not just sitting around afterwards.
So how was it? How was it for that 3,000 mile car ride? I tend to just stiffen up even if I just sit in the car and drive for that far.
Exactly. So, you make stops at gas stations or rest stops and that sort of stuff. So I would use those opportunities to get out and stretch and move around. You see a picnic bench and you use that to prop your leg up and do a stretch, on the picnic table and that sort of thing. So just looking for opportunities just to keep it moving when you're doing all that traveling. It definitely added a extra layer of complexity to it.
Yeah. For the Ironmans, what kind of nutrition do you take during as you're going? I know, ultra marathon runners are kind of known for laying out a buffet at each rest stop.
Yeah.
So do they do the same thing in Ironman?
You know, what was a big transition for me going from like an Ironman distance to the ultra distance was in Ironman, it's very regimented. At least most of the athletes are pretty regimented with all the sports nutrition, the goos and the blocks and the gels and all that sort of stuff. And they might have some other things up their sleeves. But when you get to the ultra distance stuff, the ultra tri stuff, it's much more of a smorgasbord. It's a lot more whole foods, or food, you know, pizzas and anything that's, you know, got calories that you can put in your mouth, and more meal type stuff versus, even though it might not be all healthy stuff, just, yeah. Just kind of getting the stuff in you. Now, what I did find too, well, when you get to that ultra stuff, you know, the goos and the blocks after, you know, so much time, 10 or 12 hours, I mean, you're ready to like throw up after, you know, so I think getting to other types of food just really helps you better, you know, just deal with that piece of it. But also I found that I got more metabolically efficient over time as I did more of these. So I would have bigger smorgasbord meals than the goos and the blocks all the time. Mm-hmm. So I would, you know, take a 10-minute break and you know, eat a hamburger or a cheeseburger or a sandwich or, you know, a banana and all that sort of stuff. Versus, you know, more goos and blocks and that sort of thing.
So did it take a while for your body to adapt to that switch? You think?
I know it does a lot because a lot of people have the gastrointestinal issues with it. Luckily, I've pretty much got an iron gut and I can take a lot. So I don't run into those issues so much. But I had done a lot of that kind of in my training and that sort of thing. So I kind of learned over the years how to adjust, I guess, to that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something I'm going to try to add to my training this year, is because, for those kinds of long endurance races, the, you know, being able to fuel efficiently and being able to know what you can eat and being able to tolerate it is a big part of the whole experience. Yeah.
Yeah. And the more your body is efficient with, you know, not pulling on your, I mean, obviously you want to take in fuel, you know, for the longer distance stuff, but also you want your body to be more efficient at pulling off its fat stores and that sort of thing. I mean, I used to just, you know, go out for a training run, it might be a 20-mile training run, and I would have, you know, a sports drink, and I'd have a couple, you know, three or four goos and some salt tabs and that sort of thing for my run. And now I go out on a run like that and I'll have a bottle of water. Mm-hmm. Before I used to eat before I go out, and now I don't go out. I go out fasted and with the water and still do the 20-mile run. And it's just, I've adapted to being able to do that. Whereas, you know, 10 years ago, I wouldn't have thought about doing that. I would have thought that was crazy.
So have you noticed more efficiency then in your ability to?
Just your ability to withstand longer periods of time without the nutrition consumption, so that I still on a longer races will consume, but my body can go longer distances and I don't find myself bonking like I would before. And I'm pretty even along the way and not needing those spikes as much. So I'm just, you know, I'm just able to go longer with less mm-hmm. because of it.
Yeah, did it take a while to get you? I mean, did you notice a discomfort in that transition, or did it go fairly easy for you?
It went pretty easy. It was just like you do with endurance running. It's just building it up, you know, where you build up your runs to longer and longer runs. I would build up my you know, time with less fuel over longer and longer runs, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I might do it for a 10-mile run, and then I'd bump it up to a longer run, like a 20-mile run. But I would do that incrementally over time versus all at once.
Yeah. So how is your, I know you didn't speak much or you weren't going out much with COVID, with, you know, the lockdowns, are you back? Are you still taking on speaking engagements, still going out and
trying to spread the word. Yeah.
So what's the best way for people to get in touch with you and get connected with you?
They can go to my website, which is www.liveyourbold.com, and just type in a message there, and that will definitely get to me.
Okay. Okay. Do you social media at all?
Yeah. Easiest way to find me is Facebook. Okay. So Will Turner on Facebook. There's a bunch of Will Turners, but that's one way to find me. I'm Live Your Bold on Instagram.
Okay.
As well.
Okay. That's cool. That's cool. Well, thank you a lot, Will. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Before I let you go, I have three final questions. I call them the bridge questions.
Who approacheth the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side he see.
Ask me the questions, bridge keeper. I'm not afraid.
So what is your must-have running gear or must-have piece of gear for your when you're out there?
A water bottle. Okay. I actually have a big issue with dehydration. In my first four marathons, I ended up in the medic tent or the hospital two or three times in my first four, just because dehydration is a big issue for me and it continues to be. So I don't even go out for a 2 mile run without a water bottle. Even though I'll take fluids on a course, if it's a race, I don't go anywhere without my water bottle. I just carry it in my hand. People are like, doesn't it, you know, it just becomes like part of my appendage. I'm so used to it that I wouldn't think of going out without it.
So, okay. I've got a follow up on that. What is, how many ounces and, what does it do as far as your rhythm, if you have it just in one hand?
I switch hands. So okay. I kind of mix it up. And so I don't think it really affects my rhythm at all. The water bottle size kind of depends on the length of the run I'm doing, but I'll, you know, a 12 plus ounce thing of water. And if I can refill it along the way, if I need to, you know, that's great too.
that's good. What is you've been in a lot of places. What is the weirdest thing you've seen when you've been out on your runs and rides?
There have been a lot of.
I'd imagine that might be a hard choice.
Yeah, I've swum with alligators and sharks, and run beside bison and bears. Swam with a seal on the California coast. So I've seen a little bit of everything.
That's cool. What is your word or phrase that best sums up your philosophy of life?
Live your bold.
Live your bold.
Live your bold.
That's good. Well, Will, thank you a lot. I appreciate you taking time to talk to me.
Thank you.
Hope that people will reach out and be inspired by, you know, that to do more than what they think they can do.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. I truly do enjoy being able to spend time with you here each week, and I appreciate you taking time to listen. Remember, the show notes are at ultramindsetpodcast.run. That is not .com. That is ultramindsetpodcast.run. There are links there to Will's contact information, his website, and social media accounts. If you enjoyed this podcast and you know somebody who might like it, take a minute and let them know. Send them a link so that they can listen. I appreciate you sharing these episodes with people that you know. Remember, it does take an ultramarathon mindset. If you want to go the distance, whether you're running or in life, and you can learn how to have a strong mindset. It is a skill you can learn. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.